Hey there, this is Joe with just a quick editor's note. As it turns out, we ran into a little bit of technical difficulty, and going back and listening to it, it sounded a little distorted, but rather than re-recording, I wanted to just get this out, so I apologize about the sound quality here. And second, upon listening back again, I made a math error. I guess no one is going to accuse me of being a mathematician, nor does anybody hire me for my math skills, but apologies for that too. I hope you still enjoy the episode. Thank you so much. Hello and welcome to Jaw Law. I'm your host, Joe McGregor from Dallas, Texas, and today we are going to talk about things you might have overlooked in your associate contract, and this one might hurt. This episode was prompted by a question a client recently asked me, and it was a great question. So simple. I have probably shared all or most of what I'm about to talk about today scattered across multiple episodes. I don't know that it's ever been framed to me this way, which is, what things am I overlooking that I'm going to wish that I had thought about maybe 2 years from now, 5 years from now? I can't remember, but basically, we walk into a contract and we have these ideas about various things we want in the contract going in. But we're thinking about present tense. And what this client was asking, what are those things that people wish they had thought about on the other end? Maybe they didn't think about it because it wasn't really present tense stuff. Or maybe they didn't appreciate it as much initially as they would have as a tenured associate. And I just thought it was a great question. In some ways, that's how we as attorneys look at these contracts. So it was great to hear someone ask, hey, how do you think about these things? Where I'm going to start is what is probably the hardest one to articulate, but it's not a specific contract term. It's a mindset. And that is remembering that this associateship is not like your last one. That sounds so obvious, but I want to illustrate it with a recent phone call that I had where a client was complaining about her current employer, saying, you know, all they care about is money. The office manager runs the show, not the owner. She had several complaints, and this was a long-standing client. I love her. She's great. But she had complaints about her employer, who owned multiple offices and had multiple associates. And to be fair, her complaints are, you know, that's not the first time I'd ever heard that about a practice owner. About a week later, we happened to be helping an associate leave that exact same group of offices to buy a practice. And he made the comment that he said that he was sad to be leaving. So again, sad to be leaving the one that we just heard all these horrible complaints about. That he really valued his experience there, and that he learned a lot, and he hopes to model his practice after the one he was leaving. His experience was so different that he wanted his practice to be just like this one that another client, who, again, we love, thinks was Satan's dental office. Two wildly different perceptions of a practice. What's the difference? Well, I think a lot of things, but first of all, they didn't actually work in the same office, so you have two different staffs. They are two different associates, obviously, but there are a lot of differences. When you're thinking about your next contract, you have to remember that. You had certain experiences with your last employer, whether they were positive or negative. You can't let that affect your next contract too much because it won't be the same. Even when you ask other people who have worked there, your experiences will be different. You kind of have to wipe the slate clean and recalibrate the way you're thinking. So if you come from an office that you hated, you can't assume that the next office could be full of equally bad people. Similarly, if you had a great experience at your last office, you can't assume that they're going to be just as great. The odds, in fact, probably aren't in that favor. You need to be more vigilant. My point is that I think sometimes people underappreciate how different one job can be from the next. Now, if you've had several jobs, this is not going to be a newsflash, but young associates especially, or associates who have not had that many various jobs, this does seem to kind of come as news, or at least it becomes a realization. And sometimes those differences, they impact your contract and how you read. It kind of leads to my next point. One of the provisions that we see, we call a contract for term. This contract will last for 1 year or 3 years or 2 years or whatever, however long. When you have that and you also have an early termination provision, it's not so bad. But if you have that and there's no way to get out of the contract early, so basically the employer is saying, we expect you here the full year or the full 2 years or the full 5 years, whatever. One of the issues that we commonly see is people walking into that arrangement, hating it, and realizing they're going to be stuck for the next like 9 months or 2 years, whatever. People underappreciate how long they're going to be obligated to that practice. But if you had a good experience in your last practice, this may not strike you as being so problematic. Again, you got to step away. You got to put some separation in between your last job and this next job, whether it is you need to be more skeptical or maybe just a little more trusting. The next item is people underappreciate how difficult it is to enforce a contract. Virtually every client will ask me at some point in our conversation, is this provision enforceable? Or something along the same lines. Now, I worship the sanctity of contracts. I'm a contracts lawyer. At the end of the day, contracts are vital and I think should be seen as sacred in terms of the law. So what I'm about to say doesn't mean I don't believe in contracts. My point is that contracts are only as good as the people who write them. You do not want to go into an employment relationship where you think you might have to enforce this contract. Now, obviously, the contract needs to be good enough to enforce, and so you need to work on it so that if you have to enforce it, yes, you're in a good spot. But if you ever have to enforce a contract, just know that it's going to cost a ton of money and the odds will never be stacked in your favor. They may lean in your favor, but then everybody thinks that about how they're, you know, everybody who's looking at a contract thinks that the contract favors them. But lawsuits take a ton of time, and even in times where it's pretty cut and dried and you think this is pretty obvious, it still takes more time and money than it is usually worth. I think another thing that associates misunderstand is termination length. How long does it take to get out of a contract? If your termination provision is 90 days, for instance, you may be thinking, oh, good, I'm going to have 90 days to find my next job. 90 days may not be enjoyable. And we see a lot of termination-related conflict relating to how long the associate is there. Probably the most calls I get after a relationship has started is during this termination phase. If you have two responsible adults who are making sure there's an orderly transition while the associates still get to work and earn money, no problem. But that's not how it goes. It goes like that sometimes, maybe even most commonly, but it happens not like that enough to cause a lot of problems and inspire a lot of phone calls to lawyers. Sometimes the practices are just upset that you're leaving and they're just going to shove it to you by not giving you work, but insisting that you have to live out those 90 days. And so when you're looking at your contract, you need to make sure that you're not going to be stuck in a situation. And there's a couple of ways to address it, but you need to be careful about being stuck in a situation where your employer can take advantage of you. There are ways to defeat it. You need to be asking your lawyer about those. But again, one of the critical, underappreciated provisions that may be misunderstood by you. You may actually think about it, but misunderstand how it might implicate you in the future. Have a good, experienced lawyer who can help you understand what are the problems that arise during the termination phase. The final item is non-solicitation. It's really funny to me. I get so many people fixated on the non-compete. Now, the non-compete is the mileage thing. You can't compete within 5 miles of the office, that thing. And I understand why that's important. But the people who come to me most often to ask me, hey, is this restrictive covenant not enforceable? it's usually people asking me if the non-solicitation is enforceable, not the non-compete, the non-solicitation. And what is that non-solicitation? Just as a refresher, a non-solicitation is a contractual provision as a restrictive covenant that says, I cannot take this patient or staffer or whatever. What ends up happening is the associate is going to go work at a practice for 2 years, and they're going to develop a relationship or a working relationship with this assistant or that staffer, whoever. They're going to get to know people. And importantly, they're going to get to observe these people in their work environment. So they get to see who's actually good at their work and who is not. And then when it's time for them to leave, they're like, man, I have a 10-mile restrictive covenant and I'm going to go 15 miles away, so no problem. But I have this provision that says I can't take the staff that I've worked with. Is that enforceable? I really like Matilda and I want her to keep being the billing coordinator because I don't know how to do that stuff. Or I like Karen because she's such a great hygienist, whatever. Now, the problem is that often, yes, these provisions are enforceable. They're not always enforceable, and sometimes we're able to give people the good news that, yeah, this is not going to be enforceable, but you should expect that these are enforceable so that when you're looking at your contract, you try to take measure of it to make it more palatable. And to go one step further, I get more people asking about staff than patients. I don't get a ton of people saying, you know, these 100 patients want to follow me. That does happen. What's more common is the staff. They're like, I really, really like working with this person. She's the only one who understands me, and I need her, and it's worth it to me. That's what you need to think about. So when you go into this contract, you need to think about, there's a possibility a practice might show up in these proximate 10 miles and I might want to buy it. So you want to negotiate that down, but you also want to think, you want to appreciate how restrictive the non-solicitation is. And this is tough because it's really hard to go to a potential employer and say, hey, I need to make this a little bit easier to take your staff away. So it's very delicate. You know, again, I always stress working with competent counsel, but it's important to do this. And sometimes you're limited as to what you can do. Again, if you're asking me what are some things that people don't appreciate as much at the front end that become important at the end, this is one of the big ones. Okay, so we just walked through some of these overlooked items for an associate, but I want to kind of walk back from the outlook of an employer. So if you're an employer listening, this is for you. But also if you're an associate, this is also for you because I think it'd be helpful for you to hear how we convey these items to an employer or to your boss who's presenting you this contract. So solicitation, we would tell the employer the same thing. When someone leaves, we're not so much worried about them taking patients. That's probably going to happen, right? Like that's a thing and it's really hard to enforce, whatever. They're going to take some patients. No big deal. Unless they take a ton, but they're going to get the opportunity to observe your best talent and they're going to want to take the best person or persons. Like we just walked through this from the other perspective. The person that you've trained the best and is in high esteem with your patients, has great connections, that's the person they want. They don't want your worst employee. They want your all-star. So that is the person you're going to have to protect. Also, termination provisions. We're going backwards again. And a lot of employers are like, man, it's going to take me 90 days to find a replacement. Well, that may be true, but do you really want this person you've decided that this associate is so bad that you don't want to have them around anymore? Do you really want to keep them around for 90 days? That's really the conversation. We get so many employers saying, I need ample time to find a replacement. Finding a replacement is only one aspect of this equation. Think about whether or not you're going to want this person around and contract around it. Okay, now this is probably one of the more regretted instructions that we received from clients, but we'll tell them, hey, you probably only need 30 days. And they'll say, nah, it can be hard. We want to take a lot of time to find the right associate, whatever. And they'll say, we want to do 180 days or 120 days. And at the end of the day, they're the boss. So we'll do what they say. But basically, they'll do it over our objection because it's not consistent with what we have seen in the real world. Most of the times, if you want to fire somebody and it's not for cause, it's just, you know, I don't think they do great dentistry, or, well, I don't like the jokes they tell, whatever. You just kind of want to part ways. That may be a little different. But if somehow they're disruptive in the office, or their dentistry so bad that they jeopardize patient care, you don't really want them there for the next 4 months, because if they're bad enough for you to fire, it's not like they're going to suddenly, under the threat of departure, under the auspices of departure, that they're going to suddenly do a good job or be less cancerous or whatever. You're just going to wish they weren't around. And I'm not telling you what time frame is appropriate. I'm only saying you need to think about the potential that this associate, who you thought was a good associate, turned out to not be one. You need to think about how you want to terminate your relationship. The next thing that's often overlooked or not appreciated, again, length of contract. We have employers who want to make a year or 2 year contract, sometimes even longer. We have employers who want to make basically the employees obligated to the practice. And we have to ask, is this really the basis of the relationship? Do you want them to work purely out of contractual obligation? I would suggest it's not. Now, I understand how disruptive it, you know, sometimes you need to recruit someone and you need them to be there for a certain time before you start making money off of them. I'm just saying there are other things to think about as well. You want them there because they want to be there. It's right for them. It's economical and it's a good environment. You don't want them to have to say, I guess I'll go to work because I'm going to get sued if I don't. That person is not going to be a rock star employee each day that they show up. I would suggest that the clients where we draft contracts for term without an early release are some of the more frequently returned contracts, where it's a 2 year contract and 9 months into it, we're having the conversation with the client again about something that's gone wrong and figured out how to get out of it. Well, the easiest way to get out of it is just not have it in the first place. For the employers, in enforcement, still, it's the same issue. It's very expensive. You don't want to have to sue your associate who just left. It's not usually a great use of time or money, even when you're right. We encourage our clients to make decisions where you're not going to have to enforce the contract. Now, I know there are things like, even though I have a restrictive covenant, they went across the street and took out my patients and then most of my staff. Sure, there are things that are going to happen and you need to enforce the contract, but you can't make enforcement of the contract the center of gravity that compels someone to come to work for you every day. It's just not a great environment. And I know that there are practices where this is tough, and I wish I had a better answer. If you're going to put things in a contract just because you think that an associate is going to honor it, you know, I would suggest you're dreaming. Now, I don't think it's right. I think it's wrong. I'm not saying that it is okay. I'm just saying it happens repeatedly. I wish I had a way to avoid that, or to at least be able to predict who was going to honor a contract and who was not, but I don't. It becomes really difficult. But I do think that there are warning signs. If you're missing those warning signs, whether accidentally or just because you're not paying attention or trying to deceive yourself, that's going to come back to bite you. So the best thing you can do is to pay attention and try to stop whatever path this is going down before you have to enforce a contract. You can enforce it. It will be expensive. It will take a long time, and you will now be known as that employer who sues their associates. So again, don't build your contract thinking, I need to have this in my contract so that I can enforce it. Yes, you should have an enforceable contract. Just know that it's going to be rare when your lawyers are going to tell you, yeah, it's a good idea to go after this employee. The final thing, and this applies to employers, not so much associates, but it's how expensive your associates are. And I guess this is more for first-time employers who are hiring an associate for the first time. Like, you need to really and truly understand your economics before you hire an associate. It's not uncommon that somebody will hire an associate, and I'm just making up numbers here, and they'll say, okay, I'm going to hire them for 35% because that's going to attract a better caliber of dentists, but the practice is only making 75%. Well, now you've got a huge problem because it's costing you to have this associate. Maybe it's not quite that drastic most of the times, but this does happen. And I've talked to CPAs and financial planners who help practices, and they tell me this is a thing. And practice owners maybe fail to understand the true cost of operating their own practice. They're not as in tune with their numbers as they should be when they're making a financial decision like paying someone a percentage of every dollar that comes in. Sometimes the culprit is a failure to appreciate some of the other expenses with having an associate. Maybe the cost of retreatment. Maybe they're going to be slower in production. There's just a lot of variables that need to be accounted for and some cushion that needs to be built in that I think get underappreciated at the front end of this contract. And that's it. I think for me, the important message that I want to convey here, and this is going to sound like I'm tooting my own horn, but these are concepts that we know and try to convey to clients. And I feel that some clients are really great. That's great. And other clients are like, okay, sure. But back to the mileage, maybe my message is to whoever you're using as your lawyer or even your CPA or advisor or whoever you're talking to, maybe keep that ear open a bit more and think about it. At least do yourself a favor to ponder what's being counseled to you. You're the boss. You get to make the decision. But at least ask yourself, why are they telling me this? What has happened in their professional observation that's telling me to do this? You can still say no. Nobody's forcing you to do something a certain way. But maybe just give it a fraction of weight. They've been down the line. And ultimately, you're paying for that advice. So hear it out and contemplate that approach. Like I said, even in this episode, sometimes these are actual contract provisions. Sometimes it's about mindset. Either way, I know a lot of the professionals in this industry, we've all done this hundreds, if not thousands of times. Hear them out. And that's kind of the idea of this episode and why I appreciated that question so much. There are things that on the front end of a contract, you're just not thinking about and your professional has seen it. So be open-minded and ask those questions. Maybe ask this specific question. What are some things I'm not thinking about that I should be thinking about? And hopefully your professional is excited to answer that question and share some of these same thoughts, some other thoughts. Maybe their experiences have been different, but do that. And then by yourself, also think, what are some scenarios where maybe this isn't going to pan out the way I think, and let me accommodate those scenarios as well. Doesn't mean that has to drive how I do this. It just means you need to think about it. And that's all we have for today. Thank you so much for sharing some time with us. We will see you next time.